Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
And today we're talking about Roman gardens. But first, a couple of Patreon patrons to thank.
First of all, thank you to Dan Pugh of Bunny Trails, Will Fox of Exploring History on YouTube, and the folks at Lexitecture. Thank you all so much. And thank you to Emma Polly, who's been editing and transcribing the interviews recently. Now, today, we're talking to Victoria Austin on a topic very appropriate for the spring weather and activities going on right now. Gardens.
So Vicky has a PhD from King's College London and has been teaching at the University of Winnipeg since 2019, where she'll also be teaching next year. After that, she's going to be heading to the US to become the Odin Postdoctoral Fellow in Innovation in the Humanities within the Classics Department at Carleton College. Congratulations. Her most recent publication is Columella's Prose Preface, a paratextual reading of De Re Rustica Book 10 in Selectica Classica. Her work focuses on Roman landscapes and gardens, as well as mythological narratives and race and ethnicity in the ancient world. So without any further ado, let's talk to Vicky. So hi, Vicky. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is a pleasure to talk about gardens today.
As we approach, depending when this goes out, it may or may not still be true, but we're in the spring. And gardens are very much on all of our minds.
Yes, growing absolutely.
Things, finally.
Indeed.
So let's start there with, that is one of your primary research interests is gardens in the ancient world. So maybe you can talk about where you came to that interest from. We often ask people about interesting connections in their lives. And one of the places that often comes up is where, you know, what coincidences or seeming fate drove you to the things you're interested in talking about?
No, absolutely. Well, I think I should make really clear to begin with that, and this is a question that people kind of ask me all of the time. I say I'm researching gardens and they say, oh, well, you must be a really keen gardener in reality. And I have to very gently let them down and say, well, actually, I cannot even keep a single plant alive. So this is, I have to kind of say, it's purely from a very theoretical standpoint that I am good at or interested in gardens. Anytime I have tried to do anything practical, it's like, okay, this is where my expertise ends. So yeah, so very much on the theoretical side. But in terms of, I suppose, how I came to the garden, specifically the ancient Roman garden in my research, during my master's at King's College London, I started looking at Martial's epigrams, and I was really interested in the space of the city. So a lot of Martial's poems are all based on the city space and his opinion of the city, and then that feeds into a larger conversation in Latin literature about this contrast between the city and also the country, and each of those two polar opposites have various ideological kind of associations with them. And then when I was thinking about how to move that forward and thinking about, oh, well, these spaces are really interesting and we have that dynamic and oppositional city versus countryside. But then I started thinking, well, what about spaces that are neither one of those things, that don't really fit into either one of those categories really neatly? And that's basically how I came to garden space, because, you know, gardens can be everywhere and anywhere, and they're in this weird gray kind of space between the city and the country, because they're green, but they're also cultivated. There's this wild versus tame idea and all of those things. So yeah, I really came at it from thinking about in the literature what different spaces can mean to different writers, particularly those ambiguous spaces that don't fit into neat categories. And yeah, and then as I'm sure all PhD students know, you start off with an idea, and I thought, well, gardens will maybe be one chapter or half a chapter or, you know, a little thing in the research. And then it ended up being the entire research project. So that's how I came to gardens in the first place.
Yeah, I find this even with undergraduate students, or especially with undergraduate students, they always think that you know, here's a topic, but I don't know if there'll be enough yes. in that topic to write about a whole essay on.
Yeah.
And I always think, no, no, child, what you yeah. will find, and I do not say that out loud because it'd be deeply patronizing if yeah. I did, but is that what you will find, in fact, is every topic you think is maybe not big enough for a paper is actually too big for a dissertation.
Oh, 100%. And in my thesis, it's basically centered around six key case studies, which are as three pairs basically, but right. I could have picked six completely different case studies and still like it was really hard to choose them. And again, yeah, you think, oh, is there going to be enough here? Is this too niche? And then you realize, no, there is nothing. Definitely not.
It is not niche enough.
Not niche enough. And then it's like, oh, now we've got to narrow it down. So yes, yeah. I think this is, you know, part of the course for all PhD journeys. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I certainly went through that. Is this enough to, oh, this is too much, and how do I cut it down to my chapters? So yeah,
especially when you have like a topic or an image like that that is so ripe for metaphorical
yeah
interpretation. And no, that's a terrible pun, right?
Oh, I was
going to try to ignore it, but
so many of my sentences in my research, and when I'm talking about it, I find myself saying, oh, we're going to dig into this, or we're rooting for something. And then I realize I've done it. I'm not even intending to, but it is, as you said, it is ripe for interpretation. So it's really far too easy to make those puns. And yeah, even when I don't think I'm doing it, I then read something back and I notice another one. So great.
So, okay, let me ask you then what I'm going to bet is one of the hardest questions when you were making your thesis is, how do you define a garden?
Yeah, so this is basically the question that I began my study with. I thought, well, you know, you think when I'm doing my thesis, you've got to define your terms and be very mm-hmm. clear about what you're talking about. So I was like, first of all, I need to come up with my own definition of what a garden is. And I thought, well, this would be straightforward, right? You know, everyone knows what a garden is. But turns out that actually makes it really, really difficult because mm-hmm. we become so familiar with these spaces and we can implicitly recognize them. But then if someone asks you to come up with this set of, you know, very definitive set of characteristics for that space, it actually turns out that it's really, really hard. And I spent a long time at the beginning of my research looking at, you know, I think thousands of garden definitions, and they really do range from, you know, especially if you look at different time periods, different cultures, it mm-hmm. is a really kind of broad set of characteristics. But it seemed that there were always these two key characteristics that kept cropping up across all of them. And that was this sense of cultivation, obviously, because mm-hmm. you're taking nature and trying to turn it into something for a particular purpose, you know, whether that be growing food in a very practical sense, or you want to grow some really nice flowers to look at, you know, there's always this mm-hmm. sense of cultivation in some sense. And then spatially, obviously, that's something I'm really interested in. There was also this sense of boundedness or being set aside in some way for a particular purpose. And that boundary can come in a very physical form. You know, we think of a white picket fence in the modern imagination. So yeah, these two ideas of boundedness and cultivation, that idea that it's set aside for a particular reason, those two ideas seem to be the two things that held all of these various interpretations together. And just, so I kind of honed in on those two as my, mm-hmm. as my key focal points.
What about the concept of enclosure? Is that necessary to define a garden?
Yeah. So From my perspective, and this is basically my entire thesis, is that I'm saying that, yes, we define them intrinsically by a sense of enclosure or boundedness. But at the same time, we, especially for the Romans, and this is obviously my area of speciality, they almost set up these boundaries specifically in order to then deconstruct them or play with them in some way, in order to have that play between the spaces, between these idea or opposites. Obviously, I spoke about city and countryside. In order to play with those polar opposites, you have to have that defining line to begin with in order to play with it. So it seems like they intentionally set these boundaries up in order to then in some way make us question what that boundary is doing and what it means, and in terms of physical access, you know, metaphorical, ideological concerns. And yeah, that's something that, you know, we want to think about across the board. And yeah, you basically pinpointed my entire thesis there in that question.
So would a peristyle then count as a garden
if
it had, you know, cultivation in it?
I mean, I think that's what I'm just going to jump in before you answer that more fully and with actual knowledge. But I would bet that if you asked anyone who's generally studied the ancient Rome, that if you said Roman garden, that is what they would think
that's
of. That the peristyle is the peristyle garden is like the typical
the
Roman garden for me.
Yeah,
100%. And that is, I think when people have an image, if they do, of a Roman garden, you think of that domestic peristyle garden.
We define that for those.
Yeah, so basically a peristyle garden is a garden mostly located kind of in a central-ish space in a domestic house. We see this a lot in Pompeii and Herculaneum, and this is probably why it's captured our imagination so much. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a central kind of courtyarded space where all of the plants and the flowers are in the center. And then it's surrounded by a colonnaded portico and often with columns around it. And that's where you get this idea of the peristyle from, because peristyle really refers to that architectural surround, but then it's become a byword for the entire garden space. So I think when people have this image of a Roman garden, that tends to be the default space that they're imagining. But more that I look into it, you know, this is only one type of garden space. Mm. And that idea of the peristyle garden, just in the terminology, that's more of a modern invention, you know. Vitruvius does use the term peristyle a few times, but he uses it interchangeably with a host of lots and lots of different terms. And it's really, I think it was in about 1920 or something, a German scholar really first came up with this idea of the peristyle garden as this overarching term. And then it was picked up in the 1940s by Grimal, who's a famous French scholar on Roman gardens. And it's really only since then that that's become this byword for kind of all Roman domestic gardens, when actually that's only one very specific type in the Roman imagination.
Maybe that's a good place to ask you, you know, we always like to pretend that we are still occasionally a podcast about language, even when we're really interested in other things.
Yeah.
but to make that connection.
Yeah.
What are the sort of main terms? What are the main Latin words that mean garden in any kind of, or that could be used to mean garden?
Yeah, so the basic word for garden in Latin is hortus. And that is the basic term that, you know, if you looked up in a Latin dictionary, it would come up with that term. This is where the complexity really starts, because it soon becomes very apparent when you look at the literature that that is only one of many, many terms. And each term has its own, you know, different ideological connotations. So although hortus in our modern conception has become this byword for, oh, that means garden in Latin, it's actually really only referring to the very basic traditional vegetable plot, essentially, in the Roman literature. The kitchen garden, exactly. So this idea that you would have a little garden at the back of your house in order to grow vegetables, maybe have some flowers, but the flowers would still be fairly practical because you'd use them for religious purposes in garlands and things like that. But yeah, very much that idea of self-sufficiency, and it's a productive space. It's there for growing your own produce in order to sustain yourself. And then maybe if you're lucky and you have a surplus, then you may be able to sell some of it.
And just to jump in there,
yeah,
that's the word. What's the, sorry, moving us out of Latin for a second.
Yeah.
Greek,
yes.
The word for growing things. Like even now, if you just mean like greens for your food, It's horta, right?
Yeah. So, and also, and kortos in the Greek is the Greek term primarily used as a space, an enclosed space used for growing food or fodder. It's mostly used in the Greek, the term's primarily used in relation to animals. So I think in Homer, it's used to designate kind of an area in the courtyard where the cattle were kept. So there's that kind of idea with the produce from the space mostly linked to that livestock. Whereas in the Roman, obviously from that, we then get hortus. In that sense, in the Latin sense, it seems more about domestic space and food production for people as opposed to animals. That seems to be the main distinction. But both terms have this idea of it's a kind of enclosed domestic space used for productive-ish reasons.
Right.
So coming back to the peristyle then, that is a really interesting situation of, you know, it's in terms of its enclosure, it's both inside and outside in really important ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something that really fascinates me because of the interplay between the inside and outside. And often in slightly later houses when the idea is more fully thought through and houses are actually designed specifically with this peristyle garden in mind, they tend to be in this very central location in the house. So you have to, they're almost like a transitional space. You've got to either move through it or go round it to get to various elements of the house. And as you said, so then structurally, it's very much interiorized, I suppose, by the surrounding bits of the domestic space, but it's still open to the air. So it's outside. Yeah, that play on inside and outside is something that we see not just in the archaeological evidence in areas like a peristyle garden, but we also see in descriptions of gardens. I'm thinking of Pliny the Younger's Villa Letters. He has lots of descriptions of his gardens. Many of them, he really highlights that play between inside and outside, ideas of, you know, you have a painting on a wall inside of, you know, a nice landscape scene. And then it essentially is like coming to life because it seamlessly blends into the actual plants on the outside of the room. And so you've got this idea that, yes, they're separated in some way, but they become very integral to the domestic space. And yet they're also outside and interiorized. And yeah, I find that it's really interesting. And again, that also brings into the discussion this debate of public versus private space in a house as well. Because, you know, who's going there? When are they going there? Who gets access to it and when and why? And all of those associated questions.
So we did interrupt. Do you want to come back to that?
Yeah.
But we interrupted you, or I interrupted you in talking about what the Latin terms are. So we have hortus.
Yeah.
What are the other terms that get used then?
Yeah. So hortus in the plural is horti. That actually means something entirely different. So that the transition from that singular to plural form, you know, on a very basic level, does seem to mark this shift from that productive space in the singular hortus to a more aesthetic type space for pleasure in the plural horti. I would think of horti more like a grand public park, you know, the big kind of gardens in the center of Rome owned by, you know, Julius Caesar had his own horti, Pompey did as well, Maecenas had his own gardens, those type of kind of big, you know, landscaped areas in the city. Again, they tend to be termed horti in the plural, and they're very much, you know, they've moved very much away from that original productive connotations. And so I think we in a modern sense would think of them more like public parks, but in the Latin, horti in the plural signifies these kind of grand, ostentatious pleasure gardens in many ways.
To be fair, that's true in English too, even as you've been talking about it. I have a garden, but I would go to the gardens.
Yes, exactly.
There are many gardens, and I would always think of those as being public spaces, very heavily managed and ornamental, that are meant as places for people for recreation to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would not say that I have, even though I have two gardens, one in the front and the back, I wouldn't call them my gardens.
Yeah.
But, it would mean something different.
I haven't even thought of that. Yeah, probably because, as I said, I cannot garden, so I've never thought of that distinction myself. But yeah, you're absolutely right. This distinction between And I like what you said about the recreational aspect, because I think these larger, open, slightly more public spaces, and again, we have this interesting divide between public and private space and, you know,
controlled access. Controlled, but,
yeah, all of these kind of ideas.
Intimate.
Yeah. And I think that recreational aspect and pleasure, that's very much haughty in the plural. And, you know, in many ways, and kind of alongside haughty is another term for these grander public spaces in particularly the city of Rome, and that's porticus. Yes. And, you know, we have, for example, Porticus Livii, and these are essentially, again, kind of enclosed spaces, kind of a grand public scale version of a peristyle garden, in that you have a large green or landscaped recreational pleasure space in the center, and then it's surrounded in some way by a portico, hence porticus, very much modeled on the Greek kind of gymnasia idea that you've got this central space for recreation, and then it's framed by the architecture around it.
For strolling about in the
shade. Exactly, for promenading. If you did promenade in ancient Rome, you would probably be doing it in a porticus. So yes.
So horti and porticus, then, they imply a kind of civic function, since they're not private. What about like a religious function? How would you refer to that kind of garden space?
Yeah, so the kind of religious aspect of gardens is something that I'm particularly interested in, because especially in the Roman evidence that I've looked at, there's a really interesting intersection, I suppose, between garden space and sacred space in general, in that they share that idea of being set aside for a particular purpose. You know, you get, and again, boundedness, either literal or metaphorical in some way, that idea of, you know, you've entered into something different, and, you know, you've crossed a line somehow into a different kind of space. And so with that in mind, I think it's probably unsurprising that gardens do feature a lot in many sacred or religious contexts. So in a domestic setting, Loraria, which are kind of your basic shrine that you would have in your house in Pompeii, I think it's something like almost a third of them are found in garden spaces. So it seems that it's a very popular location for these Loraria, for, you know, your family, I suppose, your family shrine, day-to-day religious practice. Tomb gardens are also a very, very popular thing, and also planted temple enclosures. So this idea that you have a garden alongside a tomb, alongside a sacred space, there does seem to be quite a lot of greenery associated with those sacred ideas. So yeah, in that sense, I think there is a lot of crossover. And because of that emphasis on boundedness, I think that for one makes these two things go well together. And then also in the Roman imagination, you know, they're very deep-seated religious kind of sacred ideas. There's a lot of tie-in with agriculture and, you know, the idea of the Lucus, which is like a sacred grove. And so you have all of these overlaps. And I, you know, there is quite a lot of debate in scholarship about these types of tomb gardens or sacred groves, whether we deal with those under the umbrella of garden space, or if it's sacred space, or if it's both or neither. You know, it's this own. And I kind of fall on the side that we can term these sacred spaces as garden space, but at the same time, we have to think about how the sacred and the garden elements kind of intersect with one another. So again, boundaries again.
Yeah, because that's really interesting. The Lucas, or that there's so many, there's a fair number, especially of when you talk about the native, in quotes, but the more Italian rather than the imported stuff. So much of that is tied to landscape. So much of those are tied to a spring or a grove. Yeah. And they are also, there's a weird or an interesting liminality there, because they're notionally wild, right? Yes. Those are wild spaces in the origin stories of it, or at least my understanding of the sort of sacredness of those spaces, are they, you know, you think of the Aeneid and Latinus going, because I only think in literature because I don't know anything about real life, but, you know, you think about Latinus going out to sleep in the grove and get his prophetic dream.
Yeah.
The whole point is you're going outside of the city into the wild. It's not a cultivated space, but at the same time, it is a managed space because there's a shrine there, and it's a set aside religious space. So if you're going to have a Lucas that goes along with a temple by the time of, say, Republican Rome, it's almost certainly going to actually be a very cultivated space. But does it hold any, does it still hold on to a sense of being a wild space?
Exactly. You know,
that it's not productive in that same way, that isn't meant to be used or wasn't planted or by or whatever, managed by humans in the same way.
Yeah, and actually this is kind of, once I've finished my current research project, what I want to, this is something that I kind of touched on a little bit in my PhD that's now been developed into a monograph, but this idea of, particularly I looked at the Augustan period and the and Augustus's mm-hmm. use of green space in the city and this overlap of the sacred and the profane and all of these kind of things. I think that idea of the Lucas, you know, do we think of that as a garden, or was it originally, as you said, that kind of, it's sort of wild, but then at some point they do become, in the maintenance of these spaces, you may have identified mm-hmm. it initially as, oh, well, this is just kind of sprung from the earth naturally, and this is just a beautiful space. But the minute you start maintaining it as that space, is that the mm-hmm. point that it becomes a garden? I find that really fascinating, and particularly in the Augustan period, where if you look at kind of domestic wall painting as well, you get this whole genre of the kind of sacral idyllic type scene that is very right. much like a Lucas, you know, these kind of floating panels where you've got this sense that there's maybe a big old tree and there's maybe a few shepherds or rustic figures, a little temple or a statue that they're worshipping at the side. Is this meant to be, do we class this as a garden painting? Is it something else? Like, where does that mm-hmm. kind of sacral idyllic and garden space, I find that a really, really interesting overlap. And how do we, where's the line between those two things? Like, how much cultivation is enough cultivation for it to kind of transition into that garden-y definition, I suppose?
Mm-hmm. And we get back here to that original problem of defining, you know, it's the is a hot dog a sandwich problem.
Yeah,
everybody knows what it is or what it isn't, but that actually is where the boundaries are.
Exactly. And I've really come to the conclusion when I've been researching gardens that it's much easier to say what one is not than actually what one is, because mm-hmm. it's like, yeah. well, it's not that, it's not wild, it's not this, it's not that. But then when you're actually trying to say what it is, that's really difficult. And kind of thinking about that shared, if we're thinking about words and terms as well, with this overlap between sacred and garden space, the Latin colere, you know, that's where we get cult and cultivate from. And there's that mm-hmm. shared association of, you know, it can be translated as to worship or to cultivate. So mm-hmm. just in the very language, you've got those two meanings bound together in the same word, idea of cultic and cultivation. So yeah, I find that there's just so much to be said, and I think it's a really underappreciated element of kind of language, and there just seems to be so much evidence of this kind of sacral idyllic space in the Roman imagination, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's been approached so much from the kind of garden angle in right. scholarship before. So I think that's, again, pun, a productive angle to kind of tackle it from.
So when I think about what I, looking at literature, because I know you started from Latin poetry,
yeah.
you've gone elsewhere, but of course that's where my mind goes too.
Yeah.
So the horti, the gardens, definitely feature. I mean, in Augustan poetry, there's a number of places where they feature in various ways. I know in other later literature, and you already mentioned Pliny, he's a big place where this turns up. You have the villa garden, or the garden space connected with the, so this is outside of the city, so you're already outside of the city.
Yeah.
But then there's a villa, and then there's a notional distinction between the productive, not necessarily an actual distinction, but a notional distinction between the productive parts of a villa or or a productive villa and a villa for recreation. And I want to come back to the terms that would be used for that in a moment. But is there a specific garden term, like would that those gardens would anything at the villa be called a hortus? Would the recreational ones, is there a specific term for that? Because that's might be a peristyle garden, but it's also something much more than that.
Yeah. So if we take Pliny's Villa Letters as an example, he does use the term hortus once. I think it's once across. The two main ones are his letter 217 and 56. They're the two main ones. And in 217, he does use the term hortus. And it is very, very specifically used in that productive, original vegetable garden type way. All the other times that he mentions green spaces, he doesn't use horti and he doesn't use hortus again. This is where Pliny, being very Pliny, if you've read any Pliny, he just brings in like a whole host of predominantly Greek terms to kind of
to complicate your life.
Yes. You know, so things like xystus, for example, these are very like obscure Greek, mostly again, architectural terms. And then he's kind of using them to, and this is where the liminality aspect comes from, because it's like, is he referring to the architectural structure around the space, or is this like the whole space that he's talking about? It's really, really difficult and challenging to, and one of the things that's frustrating is when you try and map the terms that we see in literature to the spaces that we see in the archaeological evidence, like they don't necessarily map on neatly to one another. And particularly Pliny, I think, you know, and this is very much something that he does in general, he's using specific terms to reflect on his personality. So these kind of Greekisms, this is all about showing himself to be, you know, a very educated, scholarly man. And it's all about trying to evoke that kind of ancient Greek philosophical association with the garden. So it's really, and because we don't have a ton of comparable literature with these extended villa garden references, it's really hard to tell, you know, is it just Pliny that's using these terms? Or is this like a, is this a Plinyism? Are these widespread? Is he just trying to show off? You know, how unique are the terms that he uses? And yeah, I think that's one of the frustrating things about the literature, in that we have a whole host of terminology. One, it doesn't necessarily neatly map onto the kind of material evidence, but also words are used, terms are used in different ways by different people. So it's the interchangeability of these terms that really annoys me when I'm looking at the language, because, you know, sometimes they'll use villa to denote, especially in legal texts, they'll use villa to denote the kind of the entire complex. Sometimes it's very specifically divided, like villa will just note like the actual buildings, versus you'll then have farmland that will be a different term. Sometimes, you know, villa and gardens are interchangeable. And so, you know, it's never really, they can't even seem to be unambiguous in the terminology, which you would think in legal stuff would be clear, because they're very, there's, you know, lots of boundary disputes about, you know, villas and stuff in legal texts, but it's never really clear, I find, when I'm looking at these descriptions of domestic spaces, where one type of space begins and where one type of space ends. They all seem to flow into one another. And I think that makes it really hard to kind of delineate then ideologically what each space is supposed to mean, if they're all flowing into one another.
And I guess just in terms of the terminology of that, we kind of have a reflection of that in the English terms that come from Latin, like horticulture and agriculture are very different, but there's no clear...
But yeah,
where you draw the line between those things is not clear. You can see at the extremes that these are different things.
Yeah, but the semantic fields have different centers. That's not a problem, but their edges are very, very overlapping.
And this is something that is grappled with, that very boundary between horticulture and agriculture, sorry, but also architecture. But horticulture and agriculture, as you said, where those two spheres meet and how they're related to one another is something that is explored in Latin authors. Virgil's Georgics, for example, and also Columella's big agricultural treatise. These are two texts that I work with a lot. They both discuss gardens in their agricultural treaties, but they do it in this way, and they are constantly grappling with the idea of, well, does the garden belong in my agricultural text in some way? And they're both kind of saying the same thing. It's like, well, it belongs, but it doesn't really belong. Virgil kind of deals with this by saying, well, if I had time to speak about gardens, then I'd tell this really nice story about an old man in his garden. And then kind of like 40 lines later, he goes, but I don't have time for that. So I'm just going to skip on to the next thing and I'll leave it to someone else to decide. And then Columella in his text very much picks up that challenge and says, well, Virgil said someone else should talk about gardens, so I'm going to do that. But even when he talks about it, he still grapples in his introduction with this idea of, well, some people say that this kind of topic doesn't really belong here, but I'm going to include it anyway. And then he talks about it almost as being like a bonus, or he uses financial language to signify that in some way this is like an interest payment as part of his agricultural text. So it's this idea of, yeah, it's a nice to have maybe, but it doesn't quite neatly fit into agriculture. So yeah, as you said, that divide between horticulture and agriculture, we see that now. And it's something that the ancient Latin writers also grappled with all the way back then as well.
So when I think about garden versus, so there's the hortus, the kitchen garden complicates this. So let me ignore it for a moment.
Yes, you may.
how I deal with those sorts of problems. But when I think of a garden, and this really is true of both the horti and the porticus that you were talking about, and then also the villa garden, the ideological sort of underpinnings of all of those are leisure, right?
Yes.
It's otium. They are a place of otium. And the porticus, for instance, something like Livia's porticus stands in specific contrast to a forum.
Yeah.
There are two places you can go to gather and meet and have social contact. But one is the forum, which is for business, whether legal or commercial.
Yeah.
And one is a porticus, which is where you go to have social. And of course, those divisions don't actually work.
Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons that women go to the porticus. You know, why
exactly,
and why
yes.
Livia has a portica,
yeah.
porticus and not a forum. You have a forum Augusti and you have the porticus Livia. I know you know all of this.
Yeah. Right. It's a really interesting masculine-feminine divide there as well.
Mm-hmm. And we know that like if women were going to go and walk and meet their friends, a place they would do that would be in a porticus because they don't belong in a forum. Respectable women don't belong in the forum by and large. I know the minute I say a sentence like that, there's like a whole bunch of exceptions that people make. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean.
As a general ideological.
As a general idea.
I mean. So the one context in which I have dealt at all with the gardens in this is in that idea of this philosoph, like what Pliny is so concerned about, that idea of philosophical otium, of the leisure that Horace too is so concerned with. He doesn't bring, when he does talk about gardens, it's in a different context, but one could imagine, one I think ought to imagine him in a garden much of the time when he's doing his drinking and enjoying. He just doesn't necessarily talk about it explicitly, but he's in a, you know, he's often in a natural setting and we know he's not on a, like in the woods or sitting next to a field of oats.
Yeah.
So one assumes he is indeed in a garden. Same with Tibullus when he imagines himself on his farm. Yes, it's a farm, but it's going to be mostly a villa. And it's going to be so this idea of otium, is that like leaving aside the kitchen garden, as I said, but when Romans, like, is that an important part then of what distinguishes a garden? So if you're talking about horticulture versus agriculture, is that what part of what, because you said your initial definition was that it's a space set aside, you know, cultivated and set aside for a purpose. But of course, that could describe a farm.
Yep.
And so is it important that purpose be in some way connected to leisure?
I think.
If you set aside the kitchen garden.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, definitely. I think that it's. As you've really kind of hit the nail on the head that there are other spaces that, like a farm, that fit that idea of it's set aside for a particular purpose, obviously. Mm-hmm. But there's something then, as you said, ideological about that transition from being outside of a garden into inside of a garden. But there's what complicates it is there's this range of associations as to what, you know, what is it? What is that purpose? You know, what do we do there? I think particularly in the city of Rome and these types of spaces that you're talking about, that idea of otium is really intrinsic and it can be both a positive and a negative. So it's particularly in the late Republic and this idea of, you know, the fall of the Republic and the decline, you know, ancient and modern kind of scholars have often kind of viewed that shift from, you know, that very productive traditional sense to, oh, we're now going for pleasure, as you said, or leisure. It fits into that general, very moralizing Roman discourse that you get of this idea that, oh, well, we've like descended into this luxuria and this is, you know, it could be terrible. Right. So gardens have this really interesting place in that debate because I think they can be kind of pushed one way or the other. So we do see lots of examples of people using gardens as kind of examples of like invective against people that have gone too far in the kind of leisure and pleasure idea. This idea of it's, you know, it becomes an unnatural, almost a perversion of nature if you're pushing it too far. But then you have someone like Pliny who clearly wants to create this idea and linking it more to those philosophical, very learned, a literary type of leisure. And that's very positive for his own kind of self-presentation. So yes, I think this idea of leisure or pleasure as well, and otium, really, really intrinsic if we kind of ignore the vegetable garden idea. But that leisure can be both a positive and a negative. And we see kind of varying examples. And it's a very fine line, I think, between those two things. Because, you know, at what point does it become too much? And there's a lot of that idea of fertility and abundance is good, but only up until a point. You know, you've got to harness that in some way. Because then if it becomes too much, then it becomes, you know, perverse, and then it's going over the top, and it's almost morally suspect that you're then playing with nature too much. So yeah, you kind of get these examples in Tacitus with Messalina and Agrippina in the Annals. He very much sees gardens as these places of, you know, perverse kind of power plays, and this is where, you know, bad things happen. And then in Statius's letters about villas as well, he has a lot of warnings about how if you're doing too much to nature, then you make it unnatural, that you should only cultivate it kind of enough, because if you're then creating these kind of monstrous villa complexes, then you're actually kind of ruining nature or spoiling it in some way. So I think with that leisure, it really, on otium, it really brings into question that idea of, well, how much leisure is morally acceptable? How much pleasure is morally acceptable? And where do these spaces factor into that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a, that whole, there's such a nexus there of so many things that are going on in the late Republic onward. I mean, probably before that too, but we really see it in the literature of the late Republic. And then the retrospective discussion of the late Republic that happens in the early imperial period with otium. Is otium idleness?
Yeah.
Or is it philosophy?
Exactly.
And then the otium as an important marker of status, because only if you're wealthy do you have otium.
Yes, exactly.
So to not have otium is definitely the mark of a person, you know, a person you don't want to be.
Yeah.
But where do you draw that line? And then, you know, the argument between the Epicurean and the Stoic approaches to such things, et cetera. Yeah. And yeah, the gardens, I mean, I know there's the, you know, I don't know how much you do talk about fish ponds in your gardens, but I know the fish ponds are the one of the pieces of invective that you get all the time. Like, it's those fish ponds.
Yeah.
That's where they really broke with the boundaries of nature. That's when they started growing those huge fish and caring for their fish more than for humans and pretending they had oceans in their own backyards. Yeah. That's when we knew we were all going downhill.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of this idea that when you're...
Fish ponds are bad.
When you're taking it too far.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I look at in my research is how Augustus and the kind of Augustan use of green space in the city really grapples with that idea, and arguably he's very successful in harnessing it in a positive way, because you see, and I use this idea of all of this idea of the golden age and there being this abundant growth and, you know, everything's blooming and, you know, it's all great in the Augustan period, and he very much kind of but then there's this emphasis on, okay, it's kind of contained profusion in some way. Like everything is fully blooming, but at the same time, there is some level of control over it. And that control, it's subtle, but it's just enough there to kind of harness the potential. And I think one really obvious example of this kind of visually is if you look at the Areopagus, the big altar of peace, the bottom half of that frieze that surrounds the altar is this huge kind of floral display. And, you know, from a distance, it looks like it's all these swirling leaves and, you know, it very much fits into that. Everything's blooming at the same time. And this is a fertile and abundant great period of golden age, you know, following the civil wars. But then if you look closer, you notice that, you know, it may appear from a distance that everything is just spontaneous, but there is a pattern to it. There is order to these spirals, you know, everything and everything's enclosed in, you know, nice geometrically framed friezes. So you've got this idea that it's kind of an illusion of spontaneous growth, I think, but there's this kind of very carefully constructed frame around it. And I think, so Augustus really, I think, gets to the heart of that idea of, you know, is otium and abundance, is that a negative or a positive? And he's trying to harness it in the most positive way that fits in with his whole kind of ideology of rule in general.
Makes me think that what's important is Mark brought that up about the civic nature of it, because the reason it's okay that they produce these places of leisure is because they're doing it for the people.
Yes.
For the people at Rome who do not have leisure. Yeah. And they are providing leisure for the people who have only a little leisure. And of course, if you think about the way that the histories are written, which is not the same as what happened, but the way the histories are written, Nero is the opposite. Mm-hmm. He provides a garden, but it's a garden for himself.
Exactly.
It's not right, it's personal.
Right in the center of Rome. So like, that is like, you know, a very, very obvious example of he's using it for his own personal pleasure. And you can contrast that with earlier Julius Caesar, very famously, he kind of gave his gardens like to the people in his will. And then,
Augustus did.
Exactly. And Augustus very much builds on that. He takes lots of green spaces that in the late Republic had either been mostly private or maybe semi-public to some extent. And he really does open them up a lot to the public. And he also creates new green space as well, particularly the Campus Martius. We do very much get this sense that there was a kind of greenifying of that whole area. And yeah, again, this idea of the civic and the public and the private, and it's okay if you're doing it for the people, or at least giving the perception that you're doing it for the people.
Yeah, get some of it at
least. Exactly. So this idea of that communal sense and that it's something that everyone can enjoy. You know, I think one of the things that, you know, some authors like to, you know, moan about the city is when we have this city countryside divide is that they say, oh, well, I don't have a room for a garden anymore. Marshall says, all I've got room for is like a tiny, basically a window box, you know, in my apartment for some flowers. Like, this is why I need to leave Rome in his very dramatic kind of fashion. But the evidence suggests that there were plenty of green spaces that were accessible to the public, and kind of who provides them and when and who takes them away, I think is really interesting. Like you said, Nero, it kind of encapsulates everything about him, that he kind of takes over the entire city space. And then obviously, very famously, the Flavian Amphitheatre, the Colosseum, that's a very public space. It's then put where his villa once was. So it's like a reclaiming of that space in some way back to the public.
And so you see that for, you know, Augustus, while occasionally accused of luxury in small ways, is essentially not, you know, it's so important to his perception that that their household is productive and all of those things. Whereas Nero, you know, one of the central things that makes him a bad emperor is that he is personally self-indulgent.
Yes.
And so that matches entirely with this idea that he would have great gardens, but they would, and I know it's a villa, but I mean, it does have gardens. Yeah. It does have a park space, but it's personal. Therefore, it's indulgent as opposed to being appropriate.
Yeah. And it's that idea of appropriateness and where's that line. And I think different people can get away with different things as is normal, but it's a really easy symbol, I think, to weaponize either end of the spectrum, either the positive, yes, or the negative. And so with Augustus, you see he's weaponized it in a very positive way for his own self-image, whereas for Nero, we get the complete opposite of that. And, you know, on a more personal level, again, Pliny, he's utilizing these spaces in his descriptions as a means of self-representation to put across a positive aspect of his personality. So for him, it becomes this very Greek, learned, philosophical space. So I always find it interesting in literary descriptions of gardens, you know, what is the person doing the description? What are they trying to put into that description? How are they trying to put themselves in that garden, and what is it meant to represent for them?
Yeah, because it's not even just about emperors, because if you think about Hadrian, you know, he has some gardens, yeah, and some villas, and while he's not represented as the best emperor, he's not a monster, no, emperor. He's not one of the bad emperors at all, but he doesn't, those garden spaces that I know of, and again, this, yeah, is moving well outside my real expertise, yeah, so I don't really know. But I'm pretty sure that they're pretty much personal gardens. They're personal villas, they're personal gardens. So he's not getting away with it by being civic-minded, but because he's as strongly associated with intellectual and, yes, Greek and literary, yep, developments, it's okay because they aren't then seen as just indulgent, which is also because people liked him and he was a better emperor.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Nero was technically intellectual and,
yeah, exactly,
Greek-loving too, but he wasn't liked.
Yeah, and Hadrian a bit late for me as well in terms of time space. But yes, he's very much an example of, again, he buys into that very Greek idea of the garden space, and it becomes part of that whole, you know, Pan-Hellenic, you know, intellectualism, yeah, that he wants to get across. So yeah, and I think it's just another example of, you can kind of mold these spaces into, okay, oh God, I'm going to use another pun. They're ripe for like imparting whatever you want onto them, because, and I think because of that liminality, because of that ambiguity, you can play with them in these ways and utilize them for your own kind of specific goals and aims in mind.
So as a last thought or last question, to what degree I was going to ask you about other stuff too, but we've talked so much about gardens and they're lovely. So we'll have you back on some other time. But gardens are really fascinating topic. How much have you looked at, or do you look at, or do you intend to look at some of the later focus and fascination with gardens? And here I'm thinking about the sort of 16th, 17th century English and, yeah, French, but I know the English tradition better, flowering of horticultural, yeah, works. You know, I happen to have a particular interest in John Evelyn, but that whole world of the formal gardens, mm-hmm, and the botanical, you know, the interest of the Royal Society in botanical, yeah, things and that sort of stuff. Do you look at that for theorizing? Because they obviously do look back to the classical, yeah, world, but do you look at that for theorizing about gardens at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think as my research, I think when you think about garden scholars, they kind of tend to come from one of two angles. You've kind of got, you know, more generalized, like landscape architectural historian type scholars, mm-hmm, and then you've got people that come to gardens like me from a very specific kind of temporal or geographic region, for example. Right. It's definitely something that I have tried to integrate into my own scholarship, in this idea of how do I bring in those more kind of general garden philosophical debates onto the ancient world. And, you know, I think it's always a challenge with that mixing of more modern theory with ancient, mm-hmm, spaces, because, you know, how applicable are they? But I do think with gardens that there is a lot of potential for this kind of transcultural type analysis, particularly because, you know, even within the Roman world, I'm dealing with many different types of space. So there's, mm-hmm, nothing kind of wrong with bringing in kind of modern theory, modern lenses to analyze that. I mean, I particularly use modern spatial theory to think about the ways in which we conceptualize these spaces. I know that other people have done a lot more work on things like you said, the 17th, 18th century, you know, Italian gardens, this kind, you know, English gardens, mm-hmm, as well, and how they intersect. It's not something that I have included a lot in my current research, but I think as I move on, I really want to focus more on these kind of transcultural ideas. And because I like to think a lot about how particular concepts maybe translate across different types of Roman garden spaces. So to kind of broaden that into, well, and how does a Roman garden then compare to later gardens, I think is something, you know, to consider. Mm-hmm. One thing I'm kind of particularly interested in, not as late as you said, the 17th, 18th century, but I'm really interested in this transition from, you know, the kind of, in Rome, a lot of the time, this idea of a boundary with a garden, it then leads to notions of transgression and this idea of, well, if you've crossed into this space, then once you're in there, you can maybe do things that you wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. So it becomes a space where, you know, certain transgressions are okay. Whereas we then have this kind of Christian conception with the Garden of Eden, paradise is where that different stuff is happening there. And in late antiquity, with this idea of kind of moving to kind of gardens and flowers and chastity, whereas in the Roman imagination, it can sometimes be very kind of sexual and overt with garden space. So I'm interested in thinking more about, well, how did that transition occur? The kind of pre-Christian, post-Christian idea of the garden, like moving into late antiquity, I think would be an interesting angle to kind of think about.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, that that's the other way to go, is that in the Middle Ages, they obviously pick up on a lot of these notions about the garden and really run with it, both in the religious terms and the Christian terms, but also it becomes hugely important in more secular material, like the courtly love tradition. And what the garden means there.
If you want to talk about a garden as a site of transgression and as a site, because like as literally a site of, in both senses of the homonym, because it's where you see your lady walking and you stand by, and the walled garden is a safe space for the chaste lady to be.
Exactly.
But it's also a place where she is open to be seen and to see and to interact. And so the crossing of the wall, right? Like I'm thinking of, there's a number of stories that I can think of where seeing a lady walking in the garden or looking down from a tower and seeing someone, you know, it features really importantly, and it's important that it's a nominally safe space and a nominally private space that is nonetheless open.
And it's keenly used in both the literary and the visual arts in the Middle Ages.
And that is exactly the same, like it operating in a different way, but those same overriding ideas as you see in the Roman imagination, that they've set up these boundaries, but specifically in order to then challenge various binaries and, you know, you know, chaste, unchaste, all of these kind of ideas. And I think I do find it really interesting. And I guess it's a space where you can work out those ideas because of its liminality and because of this sense of boundary crossing. And what does that boundary mean in different sets of circumstances? Is it simply physical? Does it become ideological? Where's the line between those two things? And you know, etymologically, going back to terms, the kind of old Persian paradeisa is formed from the two words which mean around and fence, and from that we get the Hellenized paradeisos, and then that's where we get paradise from, which is very intrinsically linked to like the Garden of Eden, this idea of paradise as a garden. So we have these the language itself kind of maintains that idea of the boundedness, the cultivation. Like if we look at all of the kind of origins of the various kind of European and proto-European words for garden, they all kind of maintain that sense of a boundary, you know, in the root of the actual word.
Yeah, garden and yard, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, okay, I won't, because we could go on forever now. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that, and because we didn't even touch on, say, Priapus and gardens.
Yeah, exactly. Instance, yeah.
Which is obviously where my mind goes, because I'm a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
But, you know, the god of gardens and his threatening of trespassers with his giant phallus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, just the very basic sense that the boundary, despite all that we've spoken about with in terms of like liminality and the ambiguous nature, this is why these boundaries, I think, are so interesting, because they're encouraging liminality and ambiguity, but at the same time, the Romans see the boundary as so important that it has to be policed by a figure like Priapus, and not just like any old figure. Like, this is a very, very like provocative symbol. It's both productive and prohibitive, you know, with the fact that it's a phallic symbol. You know, you've got those two aspects of fertility, but also, I mean, he's literally kind of wielding it as a weapon, right? Like in most of the statues. And, you know, the poems centered on him, you know, they are not for the faint-hearted. They are very cutting and visceral, you know, about, you know, what's going to happen to you if you transgress. So it's very... His character is very interesting because he's like teasing you. He's inviting you to come in, but then he's also saying, well, yeah, but I'm going to make you get in here, but at the same time, I'm going to punish you.
And then his punishment is a literal transgression of boundaries.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, that is what he does to you to punish you, is he transgresses the boundaries that shouldn't be transgressed.
Yeah. So he kind of embodies in just his very physical form, that idea of, the transgression aspect of that garden boundary. So, I find it, you know, particularly interesting in the Roman imagination that there is this very visceral symbol of what will happen to you, you know, with transgression, despite the fact that they then clearly always represent it as a very liminal and ambiguous space. They also really, really want to defend that boundary at the same time.
Yeah. All right. We could have this conversation forever, but I'm going to, I think this is perhaps a good place to place the boundary.
Yes. for the moment. All the puns. Yeah.
But thank you so much. Totally fascinating.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll look forward to, I know that. So right now you have a book coming out, or not coming out. That's perhaps a little preemptive.
Yeah.
Under contract.
Under contract, probably the end of next year, beginning of, what year are we now? So beginning of 2023, I think.
Right.
So yes, I'll be working on it over the next year for it to come out after that. And shortly, I have an article coming out on Columella, actually, and Gardens in Selecta Classica. That should come out this month, I think, imminently. So, so that's exciting.
And if people want to hear your thoughts on Gardens, but let's be honest, especially on memes and running and donuts,
and always
where could they find you?
So if you want to maybe sometimes get some garden knowledge, but also knowledge about various things, I'm very active on Classics Twitter, and it's at Vicky_Austin, spelled AUSTEN to be very awkward. But yes, you can find me. You can find me on there, and gardens and so much more. Many memes, many gifts as well.
And lots about teaching and stuff.
Lots about teaching, I have lots to say, and hopefully you can find me there as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more information on this podcast, check out our website, www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits, and all our contact info.
And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project. You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative.
Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is Twitter. I'm at AvenSarah, AvenSarah.
And I'm at Alliterative. To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the feed on the website.
And if you've enjoyed it, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.